Okay, if we could bring ourselves back to order, please. So just so that we're clear on what we're doing this afternoon, after we do the afternoon public comment, we'll catch up on legislative update, and we'll go to the pesticide work group and on down the list as per the agenda. So, do we have public comment for this afternoon, Patricia? Ray Ann.
He's back.
Chairman Bernath, board members, I wanted to give you a brief testimony. Ray Ann's with Council Tribe from the United Tribes on the forest chemical process and products you'll see today or have seen. I wanted to say that, make it known that Donnell's leadership and pulling together with a small group as being our staff was really appreciated by myself and I think everyone that participated in that. The offline group that developed or helped develop these recommended BMPs and changes to the forest practices application form and guidance and reporting met all of our issues that we had brought to the board back in August of 2016, earlier May.
Well, your rule petition was in May.
May, okay, so all these dates run together at some point in time, right? So the group worked really hard. They were consistent and solution-oriented, and so what you have in front of you is more than acceptable to the Eastside Tribes in meeting their rule petition, but recognizing that this is a BMP and a recommendation and voluntary, it's only as good as it's implemented. So as long as it's well received, and I think it will be by, because there was good participation by the minority group. So as the people doing this on the ground, if it's well received and implemented, consistent with the BMPs, it will resolve most of the concerns and issues that are out there around forest pesticide use for Eastside Tribes. But if it's not widely used, will likely do that. So, but we're encouraged, and I was very happy to participate in that whole process.
Thank you, Ray.
Thanks.
John Erickson. Henriksen, sorry, John. And I called you something else out in the hall. Apologies. Not good. All right, thank you, Chairman Matt and Chairman Ward.
My name is John Henriksen, and I am here today as a member of the Washington Farm Forestry Association to talk briefly about the update report you will hear later on the activities of the Northern Spotted Owl Implementation Team, or the NSOIT, as we call it. The WFFA supports the work of the NSOIT and its companion Safe Harbor Agreement Working Group in developing a programmatic Safe Harbor Agreement that can be voluntarily utilized by forest landowners to enhance the existing Northern Spotted Owl habitat and build new habitat. We realize that participation in this program by willing small forest landowners will be crucial for success. However, discussions to date with members of the WFFA have resulted in little interest being shown in the program if there is not a good workable incentive program put into place to reward participation. In the report delivered to and accepted by the board at its February 2010 meeting by the Northern Spotted Owl Working Group, the consensus opinion recommended an incentive program be developed to save the spotted owl. I encourage this board to continue to give direction to the NSOIT to develop incentives that will work for both small and large forest landowners. And to illustrate on a personal note why this, why the incentives are critical to the success of endangered species habitat recovery, consider my own situation as perhaps the only small landowner I know of that's currently focused on developing habitat for the spotted owl and the marbled murrelet. And that's without the benefit of any incentives or a safe harbor agreement. It has become clear to me that little effect can be achieved with an investment less than $100,000, given the cost of land, standing timber, and ongoing maintenance over the decades required to credibly achieve a net conservation benefit. Except for the very wealthy or crazy advocates like myself, it's unrealistic to expect private landowners to shoulder the entire cost for developing this critical public benefit. Thanks very much.
Thank you, John. Board Member Sedin.
I just wanted to acknowledge John's participation on the Sea Harbor Working Group and his insights and suggestions of making sure that our approach is adequate and friendly to small forest landowners has been crucial, really, to making that successful. And then I just also wanted to acknowledge that the message is received loud and clear, as it has been all the way through the SLIT's existence, that we need financial incentives. And I'm hoping that once we wrap up the Safe Harbor Agreement, we can get back to earnest discussions on those financial incentives.
Thanks. Ken Miller?
Are we going to have an afternoon farm?
It's just an attitude.
Good morning, sir. Good afternoon, Chairman, and members of the board. Ken Miller. I do want to echo what John has said. Even though small tend to grow the trees bigger, you would think there's kind of a natural fit there. As industry knows, there's just a lot of risks to letting your trees grow big, so there has to be some sort of an incentive there, and it probably doesn't need to be a full incentive just to talk smalls into doing what they know they do. And one of the other risks is, you know, there really is no such thing as a safe harbor, as Atlantic Oregon's finding out, the Elliott Forest, from what I understand. You let your trees get too big, pretty soon you can't harvest them for a variety of reasons. But the main reason I'm up here at this point was to chip away at your work plan. Been up here before requesting the board or inviting the board to come out at Arlo Tree Farm 20 minutes from here and take a look at a demonstration we have for a template that's out there. I think we can help you visualize what seems like a very complex template plan. So once again, ask that you consider that for your work plan. If things worked out, we could additionally include a little show and tell about the small landowner support that is given to the small forest landowners, because I personally experienced that with a new piece of property that I did, and I think I could help tell a pretty good story there. We might also include an opportunity for smalls voice their concerns, much as you did last year with the cultural resources deal. And mainly give you an opportunity to enjoy the great hospitality from small forest landowners. I'd be happy to work with staff to ensure that we keep it appropriate and beneficial to board members. And coincidentally, based on the chair's report earlier, we've already got a date set up for June 3rd. You indicated that you'd like to do a field trip in June, so I've already got a Saturday date there and all lined up. I've got a placeholder set for the afternoon session that would work just fine, so I'd love to have you.
Thank you, Ken. Karen Twelger.
Good afternoon, Chair Burnett and members of the Forest Practices Board. I think that folks this morning stole a little bit of my thunder. I was planning to testify on water typing after lunch before the report, but So I guess I'll be very brief. There are a couple of other subjects that I'd like to start with as well. My name, for the record, my name is Karen Tulliger. I'm the senior forester for the Washington Forest Protection Association. And I'll just start with water typing, and then I'll start with type in water typing. You've heard some concerns today about the lack of a default in the board manual related to type in placement of the pit or the uppermost point of perennial flow or the perennial initiation point. And that has been an issue that's been on the agenda of policy for quite a while. In fact, the original study was completed in 2006, and there was a lot of controversy associated with that study. And so I just wanted to mention that because the issue is a bit more complex than it may have been presented. I'm sending around a letter that relates to that study that was done on type-in. The second letter you have is also just a history of water typing. But I wanted to say in terms of type-in, WFPA and our member companies have significant concerns about the science that went into that particular study and how it was utilized. That's what the letter is really about. Secondly, we have tried over the past few years to put together a collaborative process to find additional science and additional data to move forward, and we've pretty much been rebuffed at the policy table for that. But as we start to move into the type-in discussion again, I think that's something that should come back on the table. We actually have a proposal initiation that is in front of policy as well on type-in. So there's a lot of work to be done on that. Once the water typing for type-F is done, we won't be going on vacation. We'll be continuing doing a lot of work. In terms of type-F water typing or where the regulatory is going, it's just a few concepts. First of all, as you've heard today, changes to rule or guidance must be based on science and balancing those ecological and economic pieces. Any proposed alternatives to clarify and change the determination of the regulatory break have to be evaluated against the Forest Practices Board expectations that you passed in August of, I think it was 2016 or 2015, and the performance targets of the Forest and Fish Report. And those are that the process is highly accurate, minimizes error, and that it balances the remaining uncertainties. Fish habitat, as described in the Forest and Fish Report and the HCP, was a product of the model. And the reason that this is important is because the definition of habitat was specifically tied to a model determination with a metric in it. And that metric said that the model had to meet a 95% accuracy level and must share remaining uncertainty equally above and below. Why that's important is that we're changing the system into something that is very site-specific. And so the challenge in terms of finding the metric for measurable progress is going to be part of the discussion that we're going through. And so this is a complex issue. It's not just a very simple issue. Electrofishing, default physicals, and a new habitat protocol will all be part of that. Just to remind you of your expectations, in August of 2015, you asked us to use existing information, develop a method for addressing streams that are not on the hydro layer, make methods as accurate as possible, balance error, minimize electrofishing, improve the maps over time, develop methods to locate the stream breakpoints on the ground, and ensure that the methods address small forest landowners. I think you've heard issues related to each of those today. And I think the package that comes forward to you in May, whether it's a consensus package or a majority report, really needs to be evaluated against those criteria. One thing that hasn't been brought up today that I think is really important, and I wanted to give DNR staff a lot of kudos on, is the changes that we've had in the water typing administrative system in terms of updating and making the maps more transparent. And then we will be looking at updating the board manual and modernizing it, and making sure that documentation in the course practices applications and the water type modification forms is really high quality. I think currently, if you listen to the discussion, you may get the impression that there isn't high quality documentation at this point. I think that is not exactly true. It's the landowners and the applicants provide a lot of information, but at times, that information is not required to be on the forms. And so the reviewers that might not be involved in an ID team may not have all of the information readily at hand. And what DNR has promised is that they will start to look at hyperlinking the application to all of that information so that an external reviewer has a very good picture of what information has been collected and what work has been done on the watershed. I think this will go a long ways towards providing better communication and actually having more confidence in the process. And then finally, I just wanted to make a couple of mentions of other subjects. In terms of budget, you heard this morning about budget overview, and I think you're going to hear a little bit about legislation. I think it's absolutely imperative for all of the TFW participants to really watch the budget over in the legislature. We don't want them, you know, snipping a little piece of money off and making sure that our programs stay intact. Secondly, in terms of cultural resources, I think that Tim Thompson gave an excellent report today on the progress that's been made on cultural resources. Several of the landowner principals have been involved in that process, and we continue to be working through solutions on that. Finally, in terms of the reinvigoration of TFW policy and CEMER and work to make the process better and make progress in that, landowners are more than willing to sit down and talk about potential reforms to the process that will help to make it work better and be more efficient. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer. Otherwise, thank you.
Thank you, Karen. Okay. Joe, you ready for your legislative update?
All right.
The main thing that I would say to start with is it's been very busy for Forest Practices Division staff. The data that I have on the slide are a little bit inaccurate. As of this morning, we've reviewed a total of 66 bills on 23 fiscal notes, and it's been a yeoman-like effort, and I really want to express my appreciation for what the staff and division have been doing. This is taking place at the same time that support for the board is being provided and all of the other usual and accustomed bits of work. So they've really done a terrific job to position us to be able to assess these bills for their potential policy and fiscal impacts. So in your package, you have a table that looks something like this. This table lists 28 bills that we rated as either high or medium priority, just to give you some flavor. I promise not to go through all of them for you today. I do want to highlight a couple that are particularly important, but just to give you some sense for a subset of the bills that we've looked at so far, that might be of some use to you. So having looked at these bills, the first thing that I'll say is only a few of them directly propose amending either the Forest Practices Act or the Stewardship Act. Very few, in fact, the number is smaller than five at this point, and I'll touch base on a couple of those as we move through this update. Where I have seen some interesting trends that are in areas related to government regulation. And specifically, there seem to be a lot of bills of interest that have to do with reducing and streamlining government regulations and oversight. And bills of this type, of course, are often of interest to the board because of your rulemaking role. So to give you some idea of the types of bills that, that we've looked at, there have been at least 14 that have proposed amending the Administrative Procedures Act, including rulemaking, including one that would suspend rulemaking altogether. At least 8 are proposing to amend the Growth Management Act, including one that would repeal the act in its entirety. 4 have proposed amending SEPA. And there have been a number that are interested in the sense that they would limit surveillance, including use of unmanned aerial vehicles and drones, or limit access onto private property. And so a few things that we've observed here that, again, are not directly related to the Forest Practice Act or the Stewardship Act, but certainly of interest to the board and its activities and role. We've also reviewed 4 bills, excluding companion bills related to amendments to the Hydraulic Code, and Chair Bernath has been working closely with DFW and others on some of those bills. So I want to highlight, in terms of bills of significance, 2 sets of bills for you. The first is House Bill 1531, and the companion is Senate Bill 5395. This is the only set of bills that we've analyzed so far that either amends either the Forest Practice Act or the Stewardship Act. The bill, the both bills, I guess use the bill rather than plural, that recognizes the working forests and the forest riparian easement program are important parts of the state's overall carbon reduction strategy, and directs DNR to share information regarding carbon sequestration benefits with other state programs that are attempting to quantify carbon storage, number one. It also directs DNR to promote expansion of funding for FREP as one part of the state's overall climate strategy. Who you've heard earlier today from either during testimony and other places, the importance of the FREP program to many. So DNR is supportive of the bill and has worked with others to make a single amendment, one word amendment to the bill. That amendment was made. Both versions of these bills had public hearings. Substitute 1531 passed out of House Ag and Natural Resources yesterday, and we'll be proceeding. So the second set of bills are House Bill 1275 and the companion Senate Bill 5393. This is a set of bills that would amend the Hydraulic Code, and the bill is aimed at streamlining permitting for fish passage barrier removal projects. It amends 7755-181 to include fish passage barrier removal projects that comply with FPA forest practice rules under a streamlined permitting process that's already in place under this law. These projects would be exempt from local government permitting and associated fees. The local government would still be, as they are now, provided a period of time in which to comment on the bills, on the FPAs. So an example of what would happen if this change were to be put into place would be that an FTA that includes a hydraulic project as part of the FTA could serve as the basis for a bridge project that involves a type S water, and it would eliminate the need for local permitting. So there would only be a single permit to bring the project under the provisions of the streamlined permitting that Fish and Wildlife Division carries out for these types of projects. So this is another bill that DNR has supported conceptually and has worked with others to have some technical changes made. Those technical changes have been made. Both these bills have had public hearings, and 1275 is scheduled to be considered in executive session tomorrow. So that concludes the presentation that I have for you. Any questions?
Questions from board members? Do you want to add anything? Board Member Davis?
No,
utterly offended that the agency request legislation isn't reflected in the table. Now, on the, no worries. If you can't laugh at yourself, then it's life's not worth living. House Bill 1275, I want to maybe highlight that one. Really appreciate working with forest industry and DNR and having the HPA be a vehicle for getting the RMAP work done sooner rather than later and with less expense associated. So I'm happy to see that bill move it along and hopefully it makes it across the finish line.
Speaking of the RMAPs, I just wanted to acknowledge the presentation that Jeff and Stephen were a part of, along with Jim Peters and of course Stanley on the RMAP program in front of, actually I don't remember which committee it was. It was it was just a great presentation on all the good work that's been going on in the RMAP program. So appreciate everybody participated in that.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up on it?
Yes, sir. Thanks for that. Maybe just for the record, forest landowners have really led the way on fish barrier removals in Washington State. And I think the reason I said I'm offended about the agency request legislation is what I'm running into more and more, if folks can step outside of just forest world for a second, a lot of great work is being done under forest and fish, not just how we do it, but the outcomes that we're actually getting on the ground. And as someone who works in habitat across all land uses, it doesn't take you very long to see that in many cases we have really healthy conditions going on in the forest land use area. And when those are in the upper or middle sections of the watersheds, there's stuff to be done down below to make sure that we actually maximize the investment that's going on under forest and fish. So that, you know, that's a statement about our agency request legislation is how do we protect fish downstream of the good forest and fish investment, and how do we get fish up through those other land uses to make sure that that investment is maximized. Thanks.
You're welcome.
I'll add that the other work session, we have another multi-agency work session on specifically on the different fish passage barriers. That was at Senate Capitol, I think, and RCO, DOT, DNR, Fish and Wildlife led the way on that. And the objective of the work session was helping new senators understand all the different culvert programs that we have in place now, and helping them understand why there's four different culvert programs and how they came about, and that they're actually, there's specific purposes for each one, but they're all complementary to each other from the context that Jeff was just talking about. Board members, please.
If I may, I wanted to call attention to one of the bill on this list, because it has to do both with small forest landowners and the spot valve implementation work. So it's House Bill 1646. And it's a carbon tax bill, and you know, carbon taxes have been discussed in various forums in our state, and the governor has one in his budget proposal, but this one in particular proposes to use the proceeds of the carbon tax to invest in clean energy and equitable communities, but also 10% of the proceeds of that tax, which would amount to about $100 million a year, go towards forest things. And then that would be split between spending on forest health, so thinnings and resilience and community preparedness for wildfire, and then also for a working forest conservation easement program that recognized gains in carbon sequestration. And so that, you know, that can be sort of complementary to the ideas in the threat bill. And then it can also help with the monetary incentives for both large and small forest landowners for spotted owl habitat. Because fortunately, our, you know, best tree growing ground where we are biggest trees to our spotted owl habitat the fastest also coincides with very good carbon sequestration. And so I don't have any delusions about the prospects of this bill passing this year, just because of the makeup of our Senate. But it's an idea that's out there, and that the environmental community and the business community and the labor community are proposing all together to, they're trying to make investments in the forest and landscape. And part of that is really focused on, you know, maintaining working forest lands. Just want to make sure folks are aware of that.
Thank you. Any other questions on legislation? Okay, thank you, Joe. Danelle. So, as mentioned at the November board meeting, we had an informal pesticide work group. Danelle gave an update on that in November. They had another meeting scheduled at the end of December, beginning of January, to finish the administrative measures that would be implemented by DNR to provide better transparency to the public on aerial application and herbicides for plants. So she's here to sort of give a final report before some of these things actually get implemented.
Good afternoon, board members. For the record, my name is Donnell Lehan. I'm the Assistant Division Manager in Forest Practices for Operations. Since there are a couple, well, three newish board members here, I'm going to go back. Jeff, board member Davis. I'll leave him alone for now. So we had multiple meetings for the Forest Practices Board Chair direction at the May 11, 2016 meeting. The pesticide notification group was formed to discuss what had been presented within each role position and seek solutions to concerns where possible. I'm going to present a brief overview of past meetings, the discussion topics, for your understanding, so that this all ties together in the final report and it can be a final packet of where we went as a group. A total of six meetings took place, May 18th through December 21st. We had representatives from Kalispell Tribe on behalf of Upper Columbia United Tribes, its Skykomish Valley Environmental and Economic Alliance representative, Northwest Center for Alternatives to Pesticides representative and defenders of wildlife, Washington Forest Protection Association and Washington Friends of Farms and Forests, DNR, and Washington State Department of Agriculture. At the August meeting, I provided a briefing on topics discussed and the degree of agreement on each topic. I'm going to provide a brief recap on those topics. One was notification. Now, these came in role positions. There was agreement at some of the initial meetings that advanced notification is important, but no agreement on how to accomplish advanced notification was found between with all the group members. Main areas of contention were a fixed advanced notification distance of 1 mile, so letting landowners would be responsible for notifying neighbors, etc., within a 1 mile radius regarding aerial spray units. There were challenges with effective notification, accuracy of information regarding absentee landowners and renters were part of the discussion topics. Compliance was the next component. DNR committed to implementing an increased compliance process. We'll be doing that through regional forest practices forester staff. And that is in the works and has been conducted. Last fall, there was increased compliance as well. Other information, we created, DNR created a webpage. There were things that we looked at that we needed updating. One is board manual section 12. We do have a target date of May 2018 to complete that. And the May 2018 date is due to type that in the board manual that will be discussed there. We'll also talk about updating the forest practices illustrative. For those that are familiar, we're looking at July 1 of 2017 of getting printed copies out to the public. We are still working, DNR is still working on a fact sheet and hope to get that out late winter, early spring. The last component was the actual FPA and reporting concerns. And the major concern was what chemicals were actually used on the ground, how much, and the date that they were actually applied. So after all those meetings, the final meeting was really to get to final agreement on where we were with some of the FPA questions. And specifically, one of the components that was brought forward was adding unit numbers to question 4 so that landowners that are, or neighbors that aren't used to seeing FPAs would be able to know specifically where they're located. And then on the subsequent question 6, they would be able to match those unit numbers together. And as you can see from your packet that came out, you see the FPA instructions, you'll have the FPA, you have a sample FPA, and then you also have the voluntary spray record in that packet. So question 6, it was again adding unit number, specifying active ingredient, acres treated, and stating what type of site prep or conifer release, and specifically a spring conifer release or a fall conifer release, so they'll be able to note what they're doing through adding a year to that box, and I'll show you the sample for everyone. Questions 7 and 9 were also added of the over 240 acre spray that has a potentially a CEPA trigger associated with it and an IDT. And additional information, like on the standard FPA, we always have additional information where landowners could add extra. So we added that too. Here's what the FPA looks like. As you can see, get this cursor to work well. Got the unit number added here. And then in question 5, you can see how we've rearranged it so that you can, we tried to create an easy process that could be filled out quickly with unit numbers, acres treated, active ingredients, but where everyone can see kind of that total combined information on one, in one area. And then you can see where we added the 240 acres of additional information.
So just to go back to that,
sure.
Put a fine point on this. Before these additions were suggested, we didn't require unit number. We required a brand name of the chemical that might be used. And because some of the chemicals' patents have expired, some of these, some of the more regularly used chemicals like glyphosate has 20 different brand names. And so landowners would list all the different ones that they might buy, and the public was getting the wrong impression, if you will. Plus, the public couldn't tell which acreage might get sprayed for what purpose, whether it was a spring conifer release or a fall site prep type activity. And so they were confused as to when spraying would occur and where and with what.
And what we'll be adding, thank you, Chair Bernath, for adding that. In the example that you have, we're going to do about 3 different examples to show variations of what landowners could, the information that they could provide. One suggestion was a large map that shows the entirety of all the units. We'll be adding that component to one of the examples. There will be an opportunity to just list glyphosate and then the EPA numbers to the right so that everyone understands it. They're just different EPA numbers. Anyone is able to type in those EPA numbers into Google and see what actual brand name chemical is being applied. But the other part that was trying to get it into the time range was site prep, which is typically done in the fall. It depends on where you're on the west side or the east side. So after snow melt, that's when that'll occur. We're solidifying the date ranges with some east side landowners to make sure that we captured the accurate time ranges. Same with the spring conifer release, noting that that's after spring bud break, so March potentially to July, and then the fall conifer release can be July through October. But we're again confirming that time range, but that will help a landowner or a neighbor understand the time range and then hopefully engage with that landowner to confirm what time frame they're actually planning on doing their contracts. So the post-spray recording best management practices, what we did is we heard feedback from a landowner that said it would be helpful if you provided something that was somewhat similar to what Washington Department of Agriculture provided so that it doesn't strike them as something brand new. And we, of course, put our own spin on it with FPA and the information we need. We need the FPA number before that triggers what we're looking at. We'll need the EPA number of chemicals and the active ingredient, also listing the surfactant or adjuvant, and the amount, the sprayed rate, ounces or pounds of what was used, and the date sprayed. This is a voluntary best management practice that we're going to try out, and you can see the voluntary spray record. This may make it look formal, but hopefully the addition of voluntary spray record helps landowners understand that it is not required, that it is a best management practice that we're wanting landowners to use, and DNR regional offices will be informing landowners at TFW meetings of this component that they can add after they spray. And what I'm going to be asking along with management support is that we were reminding people February-ish, March before the sprays began, and then do it again in the fall. So again, to remind people that this voluntary spray record is available for their use. The next piece that we'll be doing along with that is when we get a spray record into the regional office, we will scan that into the FPAR system. And every landowner, neighbor, stakeholder that is interested in spray records in their area could sign up for FPAR so that they're notified. The way the system is set up, every time each additional new item is provided, a notification automatically goes out to those people signed up and interested in those things. So they would automatically be notified. And if someone did an FPAR search, in our search tool, they would also see this if they're looking for final records. The last two pieces, specifically Board Manual Section 12, is just looking at the information that is obsolete. The technology has definitely become better, and reflecting that in the Board Manual would be helpful for folks to understand what is really taking place out there in the field, update with new information, technology, give them more information regarding what's available to them, provide the best management practices that are available, and of course we'll be working with our stakeholders on that and talking through information, the notifications that can go out, and working again with landowners of encouraging them to work with their neighbors and build those relationships, and then conducting the post-spray reporting.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you don't expect board man, updated board manual to come to the board until May of 18.
Correct.
When do you think the Force Practice Illustrated might get updated?
It's being done as we speak, and we're hoping to have final printed copies out at the end of June or July, as soon as they get back from the printing people. Are there any questions? That concludes.
So, Ray's going to be looking over your shoulder as this is implemented to see if people are accepting the voluntary aspects. How will he know that it's happening? Will he just be signed up for the FPARS and he's nodding his head, so he already knows how he's going to do it? My question was really, is there some kind of review down the road of not just compliance with what's in the rule, but the choice of people to follow the voluntary aspects?
So what I would like to do, and haven't confirmed this with my supervisors yet, but I'm fairly certain that they'll support it, will be coming back either in February or May and
of 18
and providing that information once we get through a full year of
reporting. I'm going to be moving the whole
right.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, just to be clear, because we're changing the Force Practice application, people will have to comply with that.
Yes.
But yeah. It's the voluntary reporting. That will be the interesting part to see what that looks like. And we'll also be interesting to see, to have better data on how many acres are being sprayed when or what chemicals have been found in the use and so forth. Board members,
so I was happy to hear from Ray how he's doing with this proposed set of changes, and thank you for your work on it. And I was wondering if you have a sense from some of the other stakeholders that were at the table how they're feeling about this.
I think overall they're feeling generally positive. There are some outliers of what they really want, of course, like the 1 mile notification and the voluntary spray record being required, but that would take statute and MAC change, things that we would have to investigate further. But I think generally they're more comfortable with what will be produced, which is why we're also producing additional examples so that that larger map is available. Participants Diane Harvey and Inessa Pierce that was a very helpful tool for them. There are quite a few landowners that are already providing that, but to suggest that voluntarily is another component that we can do through providing examples, but also through those PFW meetings of reaching out to landowners, encouraging them to take those positive steps forward and working with their neighbors.
Great,
thank you.
Any other questions for Donna? Thank you. All right, Mark Radcliffe, please. So this is one of the action items today before the board. So let me explain this, and then Mark will get into the details. You know, we're looking forward to updating our FPAR system to the next greatest thing, and part of it is moving finally to what we call electronic business, state government. That is getting to a point where willing landowners who want to electronically submit their FPAs to the location that they can. We've had on the books statutorily the authority to accept electronic applications for some time, but we haven't been able to do that. There is other statutes that have been adopted in the state in the last 5 years, giving all state agencies authority to do electronic signature and electronic payment. However, they also require each individual agency to adopt policies around that. So we don't have a specific policy
on electronic signature enrollment. We need to do that as a board to provide that authority so that the department, when they're ready, can offer this option to our regulated code. And so Mark is going to talk about the administrative rulemaking, which doesn't require deputy management, what we need to do.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman Nass. And the board, Mark Backflip, in the Policy Service Section of DNR. And like Stephen Nass, Chair said, I will be asking the board to consider that we include electronic payments and electronic signatures as part of another option for receiving the application and the fee for horseback applications. Our first look, and I'm very confident to say that it'll mostly all the rule language reside in Chapter 20. That's the applications and notification chapter. It specifies how applications are accepted, the timing for applications, and the review of steps for several applications. We do recognize that not all landowners are going to have the desire or even the software, the technology to do this. By any means limits how those applications will come to DNR. We want this to be a viable option alongside certified mail, dropping it off at the region office by hand delivery. It's simply, you know, an evolution from Pony Express to the 21st century, if you will. As we progress with this, we do have to make sure that we are adhering to the guidelines provided in the Chief State Information Office. They've produced guidelines for this. We have not looked at that in depth yet, but that will be part of our steps. And then the Forest Practice Division is currently looking at the new system to upgrade FPARs. Now, what that will look like and when exactly that will come in line, I can't speak to that. But we want the rule to be in place at least so when that's available, that we have the ability to accept electronic payments and recognize the electronic signatures along with what we do now as far as certifying and handling.
So, is there anybody signed up for public comment on this, Patricia?
No.
Okay. Well, that makes it appreciate.
Yeah.
So
Mark,
keep going.
Keep going.
Okay. So we're requesting the board's approval to direct staff to file the pre-proposal notice of inquiry. That's the what we call the CR 101. We'll file that with the code revising office. And what the CR 101 will basically notify the public that we're considering rule on this topic. But it doesn't expect the board to do anything else at this time. Just lets the public know that the board is considering this topic for rulemaking. And then our goal is to have draft language for you for your review and approval at the August meeting.
Draft language.
Well, to file the CR 102 okay. At August meeting.
Okay. Thank you.
Not for approval. No, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Let me make sure we have that right. Okay. Patricia, have we got a motion? Can I get somebody to do that?
Mr. Chair, I move the Forest Practice Board direct staff to file CR-101 pre-proposal statement of inquiry to notify the public. The board is considering rulemaking relating to acceptance of electronic signatures and payments associated with forest practice applications and notifications.
Thank you. Second?
Second.
Thank you. Board Member Bausch. Any discussion by board members?
This is my right too, right?
Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Same sign. Any abstentions? Thank you. The motion passes. All right. Next agenda item. An update on a small forest landowner pamphlet by Mark McKenna.
As you know, last May, the board accepted and forwarded to policy a proposal initiation for the Western Washington Small Forest Landowner Template proposed by WFFA. TFW Policy has been reviewing the proposal to determine if the proposal meets the definition of the template. This is accomplished through a literature review on science associated with RMZs since 2000 and the evaluation of current implementation and frequency of the use of alternate plans to inform this template review. They're here to identify where we are in that process and the timing for bringing the final analysis and recommendations back to the board.
Ken Miller.
Good afternoon,
Mark Engel.
Ken and I are the new co-chairs of the policy subgroup that's addressing this proposed template from WFFA, which was accepted by the board in a proposal initiation, and then we made it on to the Adaptive Management Program for review. I'd like to say that I'm introducing Ken as new because Dick Miller, that was one of the things that Dick did, and Dick was very actively involved with this until he's, I guess we can say, retired from the Adaptive Management Program. So the board accepted and approved the strategy that was presented to them from the Adaptive Management Program. And the strategy is based on the requirements of an alternate plan template that are listed in WAC 222-120403. And what that entails is a process of review, and it's several parts that have to all happen in order for us to have the information and to be able to discuss whether we what to bring forward to policy, and then ultimately for policy to bring forward and form recommendations to the board with the timeline for development of an alternate plan template for inclusion in Board Amendment Section 21. That's mouthful. So several parts have been completed. While one part's been completed, one part is in process and one part is ready to be initiated. So the subgroup has reviewed the proposed prescriptions as to how they meet criterion function as it is outlined in rule. The subgroup is still actively looking at existing alternate plan prescriptions, and FPAs over time, to see how closely they match the prescriptions as brought forward in the template. My criteria for inclusion is that you have prescriptions that are commonly used and have been approved for an IDT review. Those make them eligible for inclusion in the template. And the third is a review of the science involved in to justify the templates. That's a requirement of the proposal initiation, and WFFA did provide science to support their prescriptions. This is going to take the form of a two-part process. The board approved funding for the Adaptive Management Program to do a literature synthesis all repairing function for the program. It's a very good thing to do periodically as time progresses, to take a look at since the last review and see where the science has taken us. And then, based on that literature synthesis, review the science that was presented in support of the prescriptions and the alternate plan template. I sense there's questions coming.
Did Kim want to add anything to that?
So I'll just kind of fill in a little bit since I've been involved. Bottom line is, yay, things are starting to move, so we're encouraged. Small landowners were able to make a lengthy presentation to TFW Policy a couple of meetings ago about all of our perspective on all of this stuff. You know, I'm not trying to get agreement on where we were at, but share where we were at on all that. We got some clarifying questions, so that was some a good dialogue. Small forest landowners are now reaching out to each one of the individual caucuses with our mouths closed and our ears open, trying to understand what the concerns are from all the different caucuses. And hopefully out of that process, there might be some little clearer pathways come out of that. Mark has mentioned the science review. As I understand, the contract has been led or about to be led on that, so we're very anxious to hear that, to see if the science review concurs or disagrees with the science that we provided. That will be very helpful. I think we'll really start evaluating the prescriptions until we get that that review back. We expect the regular subcommittee meetings to continue. Mark touched on the metrics from prior approved development plans. There's, to my surprise, there's a wealth of information there. So I think that's going to be a fruitful endeavor. I do believe that there's still a lot of maybe misunderstanding, or there's still not clear understanding what the prescriptions actually are. So I hope in the intermeeting subcommittee meetings, while we're waiting for the letters review to come back, to kind of dig into those, just to make sure everybody understands what's easy actually being asked in the prescriptions. If you look at the formal proposal, you know, it's now 30 pages long, so it looks pretty daunting, but it's really, from our viewpoint, not. But I think we have a clear understanding, so that we'll all be prepared that when the science comes back, then we'll have a place to start from and start really in the full TFW meetings, perhaps, to address it. We've also got Luke Rogers from the University of Washington, Rural Technological Institute, lined up to present at a future TFW policy meeting. They've got a wealth of information on small landowners, where they're at on the landscape. It's old. We'd like to have it updated, but it will still give a pretty good picture of where smalls are at on the landscape, relative to fish streams, relative to non-fish streams, relative to watersheds, so we can collectively get a little better handle on what the overall risk is if we assume there's some risk associated with any of the templates. So I think that'll be helpful. I guess to answer one of the first questions was, you know, where are we at? From my viewpoint, we should, by this fall, we should actively be actually working on trying to see where we agree and where we disagree, and whether or not we have to go through the dispute resolution. And in an ideal world, we could potentially be here in a year with a consensus proposal. I keep telling our folks it's two years away, but that 2 years is still out there. If we have difficulties, and I would expect that we probably will have some difficulties, it's a huge ask. No doubt about that. I'll paraphrase my friend Peter Goldman, if he's still back in the audience. And one thing that people, I don't think, still really appreciate, we're really not asking for a new rule. We're asking for what was in the 1999 legislation. So Peter and I certainly agree on that. You know, he was talking about a different subject, of course. Assuming we struggle with things, I would expect 2 years. Hope certainly within 2 years of February meeting that we would be here with either a consensus or a non-consensus viewpoint. Adrian, I guess, spoke earlier about the process. Even if we go into dispute resolution, that's not a failure. It is really just helping narrow the focus down for the board. So I think we need to think of those terms as positive, help the board, that's where our function is in policy. So if you have any help with any of your questions.
Ken, thank you. It was good to hear that you thought things were moving in a positive direction. And I know board member Lori has a question.
Yeah, sorry, this is sort of late as you started. Would you spend a little bit more time describing the difference between an ultimate plan and a template?
A template is a form of an alternate plan. So alternate plans landowners have the ability to design an alternate plan.
Individual landowner.
Each individual landowner. When you take prescriptions from an alternate plan and you apply them, you find where they can be applied frequently across the landscape and where ID teams have reviewed them and found them to be acceptable, then
you have the possibility of forming a template.
That's correct.
Then that would apply rather than having to reanalyze these.
Right.
I'm just doing this because it helps us to be grounded as we throw these terms around. So alternate plans are available to anybody right now, but the effort here is to save people time and through this template, give somebody something that they can take off the shelf. Is that correct?
So all landowners can apply for an alternate plan, both large and small. For the small forest landowner community, this is seen as a way to again address in part the disproportionate economic impact, so they don't have to hire a consulting forester.
For each.
Correct. So templates are envisioned to be a frequently applied prescription that can be described in a manner in which the average small forest landowner can go out and lay it out on the ground and have a high degree of success, and if they follow the conditions or the metrics within exactly.
If I can add to that, and the idea is there's eligibility criteria, so
okay.
Is the landscape that you want to apply this to appropriate landscape.
Right.
So for example, we have two templates in the board manual now, a thin template that has eligibility criteria.
Right.
We have a no-cut buffer option for small forest landowners, and so they have to it has to be eligible for the landscape they want to apply it to. The idea is if it's been accepted as protective of the public resources over and over again, and we can be clear about that eligibility criteria, then ID teams don't have to be called on these areas if they actually
apply. And it goes in the board manual. That's going to be my other question.
Right.
It's not a rule. It's a board manual adoption by us.
The board manual section 21. Now the thing about templates is they have to be very focused too. So you have to be, it has to be very discernible prescriptions in very specific stance. For example, for a while we were working on a hardwood conversion template. Now those are hardwood dominated riparian forests where there's evidence that the stand at one point was a conifer stand. So yeah, there's a high likelihood that you'll be able to convert it from a hardwood riparian forest back into a conifer dominated forest. Very specific.
So if I could embellish on that a little bit from both angles. The natural question is, well, gee, if alternate plans are already available to smalls like they are to bigs, why do we need this? An alternate plan is very intimidating to the average small forest landowner. I'll give an example of our past presidents, Tom Wester, who I may even have come down to one of our subcommittee meetings, is a trained forester, been around the industry for years and years, and was very reluctant to try to do one of these alternate plans. It built up these fears in his mind about that, gee, all these people come out looking at my land, and he finally went through the process, sucked it up, and went through it. It turned out to be a very, very good process for him. In fact, he ended up with a
his own Alderton plan turned out to be coincidentally very similar to what we've got on the table. But the vast majority, the 200,000 small forest landowners, most of them only have one harvest once a year. It's not like they're doing it every year. So there's just an inherent reluctance to even go down that route, and especially if it means they've got to hire somebody to do it, because we are all so very tight. The tightest bark on a tree in the wintertime, I guess. The flip side of that is, it is, as Mark indicates, still an alternate plan. So even though the intent is to not necessarily have ID teams out there, we still can have ID teams. The difference is, if it's a full, normal alternate plan, as I understand the process, an ID team is required. However, on a template, because these prescriptions have already been vetted and everything, is optional. The DNR forester, when he gets an audit plan template, he will reach out to the other stakeholders and ask, would you like to have an ID team? And somebody raises their hand and says, yes, we would like to have an ID team on that particular property, then there is an ID team.
Mark, do you want to address the standard for an alternate plan?
Yeah, they have to meet the protections as called for in the rule. And the rule is for that, or a general way, they have to meet the intent. So what that means is that you can go in and perform a harvest, and you may reduce riparian function slightly as long as you leave the forest in the condition that it will grow back faster. And if you can achieve riparian function that may not be there now, so it's the complete restoration of riparian function. That's the goal.
I'll add a little bit to that, because you'll probably end up hearing about this when we ultimately get back to the forest practice board. There's two factors, and I don't have all the language, but what Mark was just going about is the approval standard for alternate plans. And it says words to the effect equal to in overall effectiveness to the protections provided in the rules and the act. And then there's additional language in the act that says that small landowners are entitled to or required to have alternate harvest prescriptions that are relatively low impact. So now, what did those words and phrases mean? That's the kind of stuff that TFW policy is going to be wrestling with before they get to you. So they're very, it's general. It's kind of in the eye of the beholder, but the bottom line is, Mark alluded to, the protections ultimately have to be very similar to what the rules and the act already require.
So to summarize, first, I feel we have a new prescription, and that's that perhaps some of these can only be applied on the sapless blowing, so you're not as tight. So the next steps, the literature synthesis is that we need to initiate that we are putting together the contracts, there is funding. The goal is to have the literature synthesis and the science review completed by June 30 of this year, the end of the fiscal year. The subgroup will meet and finish the other aspects. When we have all the data, then we'll begin to do the evaluation of the prescriptions and then take them to the policy, probably at the earliest, late summer, most likely in the early fall. The next step is for the subgroup to take it to policy, and then policy will come forward to the board with recommendations. It may be the extremes from the proposal does not meet the criteria for a template to it does, or some version in between where perhaps some of the prescriptions would be eligible for a template. And then policy needs to provide to the board the timeline in which the full template would be developed. So the next step for the board would be policy coming forward to you with recommendations in order to finish the evaluation and then bring final recommendations to the board for board action. Most likely in the form of a template for inclusion of board members, section 21.
Any other questions for board members?
I'd like to make a statement if I could.
Sure.
I just really appreciate your persistence on this issue. And I also appreciate the fact that you're not doing it for yourself. It's like you and I are planting trees for the future. And so the poem that you read this morning was very meaningful to me because it is for our futures. So thank you.
Thank you. And if you want to get a little bit of a head start on this and visualize what we're actually talking about, when we get to the board plan in 2017, you'll accept my invitation.
You and board member Davis are in the same club as far as your ability to promote your issues.
Never pass up an opportunity.
Okay.
I'm working on my phone.
Martex.
Planting fish for the world.
As some of you know, the Water Pollution Control Act and the Forest Practices Act are nicely integrated. Ecology adopts standards for water quality, evaluates current monitoring data to discern what waters in the state may be impaired. The board adopts rules that are intended to meet clean water requirements. Ecology, or MARA, will be discussing with us the latest 303D listing in the state with a focus on forest lands. This can also, depending on your view of things, can be used as one measure of how we're doing out there. So, Mark, you want to take it away?
Yes, thank you, Chairman Burnett. Thanks for inviting me and members of the board. I'm Mark Hicks. I work with the State Department of Ecology. I wear a lot of hats. I'm essentially the programmatic lead for forestry issues for the Water Quality Program. One of the things I don't normally work with, however, is the topic I'm about to give a presentation on. Unfortunately, the people who do this work were not available today. They were kind enough to help put together some slides for me, which I probably added to a little too much. So we'll see how this works out. I'm doing a few promotions of something else that I do talk with you about at the end. So, but I want to stay consistent with the pattern. All right, let's see where we're at. Okay, so I want to talk to you about something we call the water quality assessment. And I'm going to focus on forest land. This is, of course, much larger than forest land with the statewide assessment. And I want to try to keep it focused on where your interests are. So in July 2016, Ecology received approval from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for our most recent water quality assessment. The purpose of this presentation today is to describe what the assessment is. I'm sure a lot of you aren't that familiar with it. And how the list of impaired waters on forest lands has changed since our last assessment. So the water quality assessment is a comprehensive assessment of the quality of Washington's waters. It's actually required under Section 303D of the Federal Clean Water Act. It helps us keep track of whether water bodies are getting cleaner or dirtier, to put it in simple words. And it allows us to set priorities for protecting and improving water quality. And it's all about protecting beneficial uses of that water, such as fishing, swimming, and water supplies. Aquatic life. I want you to remember the word priorities. That's going to be important later on. And in jargon terms, it also provides an integrated report to EPA on how are we doing with water quality in the state. So when
you get want to explain what that means?
No, I do not. But thank you for the opportunity. That was one of those slight attributes that is really not in my corner.
I could help you.
And you would be welcome. So when we do a water quality assessment, we put waters into one of five categories. Category one is that it meets the tested standards. We're talking about the surface water quality standards for the state.
Category two are waters of concern. Category three is insufficient data to do an assessment. And so of those first three categories, one could say that, you know, they are not known at least to be impaired. We can't be sure there isn't something, but they're not known to be impaired and no TMDL is required. And it changes a little bit as we get to the next two categories.
What's a TMDL?
Gonna get there though. Just a moment, I'll be happy to. In fact, that's a good thing to just do right now. So TMDL is jargon, the total maximum daily load analysis. So through the years, and I haven't been around a long time, so through the years we've tried all kinds of different terminology, but the basic jargon that came with this program still lives on. Essentially, it's a scientific assessment of the amount of pollution from the various sources that a water body can assimilate without being in violation of the water quality standard. And so when we do a total maximum daily load analysis, we essentially assign certain amounts of pollution each source out there can continue to discharge or contribute in some way to the water body and still allow us to have our water bodies meet those fishable, swimmable goals, to meet the water quality standards and thus protect all those uses. So that's essentially what a TMDL is. We try to call them things like water cleanup plants though, instead, to make it a little less germany. Category four and five are both what we consider to be impaired waters. Category four actually has three potential subcategories to them. A, it already has a TMDL that's been established for the water body. B, it has some other water pollution control plan that functions the same as a TMDL. And the third category is it's actually impaired, but it's impaired by a non-pollutant. Good example would be a dam. Major physical modifications to a water body is not technically a pollutant, but it can be a cause of impairment and can result in waters being listed. Category five is the actual 303D list. It's impaired, and for these we have to either develop a TMDL or some other form of a water quality cleanup plan. I think what the board chair was trying to allude to, this whole all five categories together are essentially our integrated report as we move those forward. So how do we put the list together? Well, it begins with developing written policies to help determine when a water body is polluted or showing signs of pollution. Then we compile all the available water quality data that meets state credible data requirements. And this is important because we don't just use data that is collected by the Department of Ecology. We actually do a call for data and we collect data from a wide range of stakeholders and sources. And that data has to be reviewed to make sure that it has a credible data plan behind it, that we can have some confidence in that data. Then we make an assessment of the data by comparing it to our existing water quality standards to see if we have problems. That first bullet actually about the written policies also includes how we use the data, how much data we need to be convinced that in fact there is an impairment or a likely impairment. And finally, waters on category five, the 303D list, require a maximum daily, total the maximum daily load, bring waters in fact into compliance with the standards. And that's a very data-intensive, resource-intensive effort to develop those. It takes quite a while. So to kind of restate this kind of simplified term, so the goal of the 303D list is to identify waters impairing or suspected of impairing beneficial uses such as aquatic life, recreation, water supply, and then to implement or encourage changes that reduce pollution or clean up impairment so that those beneficial uses will be protected. This is a statewide map showing the listings in categories four and five of waters that are impaired by temperature alone. And the person that was helping put the slides together and I both tried different ways to make this map a little more legible. In the end, though, I think I suggest if you really want to understand it, there's a lot more information available. We do have interactive system on our webpage, and that's what's referred to at the bottom here. So you can go to our water quality atlas and actually look up individual parts of the state, what they're listed for, and we're making this a better tool all the time. Okay, so how are we doing in forestry and water since the last assessment? So the number of listings for all categories of pollutants has gone up. We have assessed more waters, and I'm told that it isn't just all brand new waters. A lot of water we had an inadequate amount of data available to us to do the assessment, so it was in that category too. And over time, we've gotten enough data that using our policy, we think we could do the assessment. So the number of water bodies we could do an assessment went up. The number of listings for not meeting the temperature criteria also went up. These are total listings. Now remember, we added a lot more to the assessment too. So there's another slide is going to say this again, I think, but you know, essentially there was a change from 66% of the waters we assessed in forest land was impaired for temperature in our prior assessment. This time it has moved up to 68%. Is that a trend? No, it's not really. One of the other things that happened here is that, and this happens periodically, is we're always trying to figure out how to set the footprint for these impaired waters listings. And we actually made a major change in this last assessment, and we went to a different, we'll call it a water body segment scale approach, using a national hydrography data set, or a tool that more people are using throughout the country, EPA come up. That's good. Difference is when you change the footprint, it makes it really hard to do a one-to-one comparison over time. And so you can't really, and this tool wasn't even developed for tracking trends. So the number of listings meeting temperature criteria, the category one, also went up. And again, we assessed more water. And the number of listings that are waters of concern, they have data that looks like they might be in trouble, but not enough to say they're impaired, also went up. Kind of a mixed message here. So no, you can't say that there was a significant change in any direction at this point, I would say. This summarizes it again. So about 10% of all waters in Washington have been assessed for some water quality parameter. That's statewide for all possible pollutants. Temperature is the most common cause of aquatic life use impairment in Washington state. The total number of temperature impaired waters for forest land increased 43%, but the relative proportion increased by only 2%. Reasons for the increase in listings. Impaired waters largely reflects an influx of data from water bodies that previously had insufficient data. The percent change in listings from the 2012 assessment doesn't tell us whether statewide waters are getting better or worse. We can track an individual water body pretty good over time, but we can't tell you what a state trend is because of all the changes in the numbers and locations of data. The assessment only identifies water body segments with data showing the standards are or are not being met. Okay, now this is all my fault. I'm going forward. So I thought particularly with some new board members, it might be good to kind of circle back around and say, how does this become meaningful to some of the conversations here at this table, this room? And it's in, so I brought in a few slides to talk about the Clean Water Act assurances, and there is a update report in your board packet. And so Ecology has agreed to give updates on these water quality assurances essentially every 6 months to the board. So for new members, this will be something you'll see regularly. And I thought this might be a good opportunity to show you how this works. So Ecology, with support from EPA, provided the Clean Water Act assurances that are in Schedule M2 of the Forest and Fish Report. The Clean Water Act assurances and the HCP form a package of federal and state assurances that create more regulatory certainty. Remember, you heard earlier some public comment about the importance of certainty. So in the negotiations, that was very clear that it was very important for all the stakeholders, particularly the landowners, to have this regulatory certainty. And so one of the ways this came about is through granting things like the Clean Water Act assurances. So what's being assured? TMBLs, those water quality cleanup plans, where we try to apportion the waste load, and if it's necessary, try to enact changes that will bring waters into compliance. Those are a low priority until this has been negotiated, but I know it's not, it's past 2009, I'll get there. TMBLs are a low priority until 2009 in watersheds where forest practices are the primary activity affecting water quality. So if you're in a watershed, it's all forestry, and the water quality is being impaired, we still put TMDLs as a very low priority. Remember, we have a system of prioritization. So we put those as the lowest priority, and with a list of TMDLs to do that are higher priority, we really aren't likely to get to them while they're at the bottom of the list. TMDLs in mixed-use watersheds. So we have watersheds that are not just forestry. We have urban centers and such in small towns, and wastewater treatment plants and fish hatcheries and all kinds of things out there. And if there's enough of those, we call it a mixed-use watershed. And in those watersheds, we may do a TMDL. When we do a TMDL, however, when we implement the TMDL, we apply no more stringent Clean Water Act requirements than established under the Forest and the Practices Rule, unless those rules, of course, are modified through the Adaptive Management Program. So when these assurances were issued, as part of the Forest and Fish Report in 1999, it was assumed, optimistically, that within about 10 years, that would be enough time for us to understand whether the rules are working to bring waters into compliance with water quality standards. For a lot of reasons, including the fact that CMWR was very much involved in those early years in trying to develop rule tools and help implement the rules. We didn't collect the information within this program necessary to actually make that assessment. So in 2009, when the deadline came due, Ecology did a review of the entire program and extended the assurances contingent on meeting specific corrective milestones. And those are the ones that you see in the report that's put in your board package. So why were these assurances granted in the first place? Well, both federal and state agencies recognized that the Forest and Fish Report prescriptions were a significant improvement in water quality protection, and that there was a chance that they may meet water quality standards long term. So that reduced the urgency to develop TMDLs or set out on establishing the alternative implementation requirements to forestry. Connected with this, and very important, is that it's contingent on that we're recognizing that we have a well-funded and structured adaptive management program that has a direct linkage in state law and rules to refining the prescriptions if they are not effective in protecting water quality. So we count on that process, that adaptive management process, to make sure that, to find out, are the rules working to protect water quality, and if they're not, what do we need to change so that they do make it? So that's the main heart of why there are these Clean Water Act assurances. Any questions?
Remember Valley.
How often does Ecology do the water quality assessment?
It takes a really long time. It's been, I think this one's like 7 years out. The data, the actual data is 7 years old now. The system is based on. They're trying to find a way to get into the cycle that we prefer, which would be about every 3 years.
Have you guys done an analysis, or do you plan on doing an analysis to see how many of the streams in the forested environment that are not meeting their temperature goals are head down versus head back streams?
There's no plan to do so.
Does it seem like it might be a good idea to do that?
We could pass that along.
From
all that I've ever learned, it's really well distributed across all kinds of the waters across the state. Temperature listings are very ubiquitous. And so there's reasons to assume that maybe a headwater and a clear cut might have a higher frequency, but at the same time, a main stem water has a high probability of exceeding those two, even just due to natural conditions.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's
definitely.
you didn't do an analysis of the different jurisdictions for forest land, did you?
No, not to my knowledge.
Okay. Because I know in previous reports to the board, you know, we tried to identify the difference between those with state and private land versus federal lands.
So unfortunately, the staff that are doing this didn't have time. I actually asked for that.
Oh, okay. Thank you. So I guess what I want to remind the board is the clean water studies associated with Sanger have been really important, not just because we have, because of the confidence that we might have when we negotiated buffers in 99. You know, for example, we had a lot of confidence in the type of buffers that we negotiated. We had less confidence and did the best we could based on the science we had at the time. And so there's been a priority, for example, on type N studies to make sure we got those right, and second, to make sure they're actually effective in the context of water quality standards. So when he brings that list of things to do to us every so often, you know, the good thing is we've knocked a whole bunch of them off the list, and some of what is left is just getting to it. Some of what is left are operational things we need to find too. I mean, like for example, we talked about performance audits this morning. You know, that's on the list. We've had that on the list for some time. We've got to get that done.
I would like to add, if I may, that some of the highest priority projects, such as Type N, are the ones that have been delayed the longest. And they were a high priority identified right after the forest efficient negotiations by consensus and are in the senior work plan. And yet, those are the ones that are still having a real hard time getting on the ground.
Yes, Board Member Wolf.
I just had a few questions. You said that the current assessment was done how long back?
I believe it was the assessment's been ongoing, and it was just approved in July of 2016. But the process of actually doing the data quality assessments and moving it through the whole public process that we established before we actually submit the list to EPA, and then have an interchange with EPA about the proposed list and then have them approve it, that ends up taking quite a long time. And I know that that's something we're not happy about. We're trying to tighten it up. I think we've refined our process sufficiently enough and automated it enough that I think it is reasonable to expect that we're going to be able to get closer to our goal of doing this at least every few years.
Okay, another question then. When was the prior assessment done then?
2012 is what it's called. 2012 assessment.
Was there any overlap on the assessments as far as?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the data continues to be used for water bodies.
And was there a determination when there was overlap of an increase in the temperature of those that were?
You're going beyond me here. So what do you mean by overlap?
The prior assessment and then the current assessment, were the same water bodies tested, the prior and the current, or am I missing?
Oh, some water bodies they have continuous data collection, and we get those submittals from the various entities that are collecting it, including ourselves, long term. What I don't know, and I'd like to just back up just a second on your prior comment, I don't think my response was really appropriate. We have a listing policy, and that policy includes how we handle that data. And that's a level, and I don't have the level of familiarity with that listing policy right now to really honestly be able to respond to those questions. If you're interested, I can find that out for you, or we can invite back for another meeting the staff that are actually doing those assessments.
Mark, maybe you can send Patricia a link to policy 1-11.
Yeah.
And then that can be sent out to the board.
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
Yeah. And then we can get a sense of
what's a standard for review of data that comes in? There's a, something I'll comment on, this last listing took forever to happen. But what's also happening, it's always taken at least 2-4 years. Because I think I reported to the board when I was in a different chair in 2004 and 2008. And it is incredible how much data they look at. We've got this massive database called EIM, Environmental
Information
Management. Yeah, and anybody in the public with QA/QC data can submit data to it. So it's not just ecology studies, it can be from the Forest Service, private landowners, counties, etc. Any other questions for Mark?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. Mm-hmm. All right, Warren. So, as you know, Warren continues to, and I thank her every time I see her, to work on a draft safe harbor agreement with the NSLIT group. It's nearing. We've actually sort of got a drafty piece of paper now. Lauren's going to pick up where she left off with you, and she talked a lot about baseline requirements in the last meeting. We want her to continue to bring the board along as different pieces get put into the draft, so that when they are ready to bring to the board a proposal, if that becomes necessary, then we're up to speed if it's not, you know, based for us.
Great, thank you, Chair, for the introduction. Good afternoon, Chair and members of the board. Just to kind of remind folks what we had talked about at our last meeting, I'm going to spend just a little bit of my PowerPoint reminding what we did talk about and tell you all what's new and what's up next. So the priority of the implementation team the past year has been providing guidance to the Safe Harbor work group members, and a huge thank you to all the work group members who have been participating and helping us develop the major technical and policy considerations of this programmatic Safe Harbor agreement. Just to remind members, we want this to be a voluntary enrollment process to allow landowners the federal assurance that could come with doing beneficial activities to recruit and retain spotted owl habitat without running into additional ESA regulatory conferences. So the thought is we would have kind of a one-stop shop where any interested landowner, large or small, would contact DNR and apply for enrollment. And it's voluntary. DNR will use the guidelines enshrined in the programmatic Safe Harbor agreement to kind of provide sideboards on what activities would be covered under this program. And we're also opting to do additional analysis of impacts on the front end in the hopes that it can make the process a little quicker and smoother for landowners on the tail end so that we can try to streamline technical analysis as much as possible on the front end. So because of that, we're doing an environmental assessment through NEPA, and our expectation is we would tier those sorts of applications under that environmental assessment. So if everything checks out and DNR approves the enrollment document that the landowner has applied for, then they would receive protection approved for above baseline activities. And that would be an enhancement of survival permit under 1091A of the ESA. So to kind of illustrate that, it's an umbrella permit. So we're using the programmatic SHA guidelines and the protection of enhancement of survival permit to guide the landowner's individual enrollment application, and the instrument that they receive their protection under that enrollment permit is something called a certificate of inclusion, and that's literally a one-page document that says we checked it, they're protected under this umbrella permit. And the thought would be then that any forest practices applications associated with that program would not be classed for special for a spotted owl, and that would get them out of that classification. And if there's anything else that could possibly trigger SEPA that's not related to the owl, that's still, you know, on the table. This is just for getting landowners out of class four special trigger related to spotted owl encumbrances. So just to kind of reorient land members to some terminology. Baseline is something that services define as population estimates and distribution or habitat characteristics and determine the area of the inland property that sustains seasonal or permanent use by the covered species at the time the Safe Harbor Agreement is executed. So basically, it's a snapshot of the inland property of seasonal or permanent used habitat that's currently there at the beginning of the moment. So using that definition, we have defined baseline as spotted owl habitat inside status 1 through 3 circles, where less than or equal to 40% of the area of the circle meet the definition of spotted owl habitat. And just for ease of awareness, and we're using the habitat definitions in our forest practices rules. So we have forest marginal submature old growth. So we'll have a table for that, so it's relatively straightforward for landowners to know, you know, what's baseline, what's not. So, unlike a habitat conservation plan where you can have mitigation debt and you can swap out your incidental take and all that, a Safe Harbor Agreement does not allow for mitigation debt. So we have to protect the baseline for the entire duration of the agreement. So you're basically taking a snapshot, and then anything that you do above that receives your, you know, Safe Harbor assurances. So with that, we've really been trying to design a program that allows for, you know, as much flexibility for the landowners as we can possibly provide, recognizing that this instrument does not allow for mitigation debt. So a net conservation benefit is another term that's used in Safe Harbor terminology, and it's basically, you know, what are you doing that's better than what we had yesterday kind of thing. A net conservation benefit is basically the articulation of beneficial activities to the species that would have not otherwise existed had you not entered into the Safe Harbor Agreement. So some examples of conservation benefits can include, but are not limited to, maintaining, restoring, or enhancing habitat, increasing habitat connectivity or reducing fragmentation, maintaining or increasing species population numbers, buffering protected areas, testing conservation strategies, and reducing the potential effects of catastrophic events. So a net conservation benefit is what every landowner will have to aim for in order to actually be eligible and participate under this program. So the way you get there is by listing or determining what these conservation measures are. Conservation measures are the kind of pre-approved activities, types of activities that would receive protection under this program that allow a landowner to achieve net conservation benefit. And the thought, just very simply, is this is a habitat recruitment retention program. There's a lot of activities out there that could benefit the spotted owl, but for ease of trying to get something on the ground that's workable, we are focusing on forest management, so activities that develop habitat, maintain, enhance, and then in all cases, there's a requirement to protect baseline habitat on enrolled properties. So we have, as I told the board members before, the implementation team and our technical team analysis and Fish and Wildlife Service recognizes that barbels are having a negative impact on spotted owl population. And we recognize through our technical team analysis that habitat and barbels kind of have to go hand in hand. We have a paragraph within the program that says nothing's stopping a landowner today from individually contacting the Fish and Wildlife Service to talk about barbell removal strategies or options, but that is not going to be a component of our programmatic Safe Harbor Agreement. We're just focusing on maintenance, recruitment, retention of spotted owl habitat. All right. So, question?
Just really quick. Because I know that was a topic that landowners were interested in. And correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't the main reason we're doing that is because the experiments are still underway and we're really not sure what it would take to be able to successfully do that?
Absolutely. That's you know, so a good way to put it. In consulting with the Fish and Wildlife Service on this recommendation, they said we're still probably about 10 years away from a programmatic kind of approach to barbell removal. You would need to apply to do any sort of removal at Migratory Bird Treaty Act permit. Which is, and considering that this is an umbrella program, program for Safe Harbor Agreement, it has a survival permit, and we then have to additionally create a programmatic migratory bird treaty act permit. I'm not sure if they have that yet. So I think what the thought is we're creating a program that can start today, theoretically. And should there be future conservation measures that pop up and it makes sense to incorporate it at that point in time, we can always amend the Safe Harbor Agreement. But again, nothing's precluding landowners from individually communicating with the services on that. So good question. So recognizing that sometimes it's a lot easier for me to show you than to tell you, I'm just going to run through a couple images to help conceptualize what this net conservation benefit looks like, a baseline, and what the timeline would be for a landowner who is participating in this program. So the thought is the easiest situation, cut and dry, for a landowner applying is if you have zero baseline at the start of your agreement. So you've got you have a forest margin, no habitat currently on your property. And the thought would be maybe you want to recruit a forest marginal, but you want federal insurance protection before you do that. So you start with zero baseline. The net conservation benefit is that blue triangle that is additional habitat growth and maintenance. So maybe you're recruiting young forest marginal, and this is all kind of above baseline. So the thought is at the end of the agreement, after net conservation benefit has been achieved, you can then harvest back down to baseline. And it should also be noted that in trying to make this as flexible as possible for landowners, we are making this both opt-in and opt-out. So we kind of have developed some programmatic Safe Harbor Agreement to expect that there are some landowners who may finish the entire program from start to finish and everything kind of goes off without a hitch. But there might be other situations in which a landowner may need to terminate their agreement early. And the thought is, as long as we're not creating mitigation debt and everything is still there from that snapshot, that the landowner would have flexibility to do that. So this will be the easiest situation for a landowner. And if you have baseline, the baseline habitat, that dark rectangle at the bottom, must be maintained for the duration of the agreement. And as you're going through your program and you're creating that conservation benefit on your landscape, anything back to that baseline threshold is kind of additional net conservation benefit that you'll be eligible to harvest. So you start, baseline, you finish, you still have baseline. And if you don't have baseline, but want to offer an elevated baseline as a net conservation benefit, and I'll have a couple more slides to explain exactly what an elevated baseline is. But the thought is this would be a good situation for incentivizing landowners to leave additional habitat on the landscape. So the concept of the Safe Harbor Agreement is that you're providing temporary benefit to the species that would have not otherwise existed had that program not been implemented. So the thought is, via ROS or other source of conservation easements, for whatever reason, a landowner decides they don't want to harvest back down to baseline. So they agree to an elevated baseline, perhaps because it speeds up their ability to achieve net conservation benefit and harvest sooner, or they're leaving more on the landscape. It would be that new elevated baseline that they could harvest down to at the very end of their agreement. And the thought is also with the elevated baseline concept, if you had baseline to begin with, but you still want to leave more than was there to begin with, you just raise that threshold up there. So there's basically three bins of elevated baseline. There's elevated baseline purely because you're being incentivized to leave more habitat on the landscape that you grew. And a voluntary conservation measure. You're deciding to choose that as a voluntary conservation measure to achieve net conservation benefits sooner. The second option is elevated baseline as a means to prevent mitigation debt to baseline. So perhaps there's activities that could impact baseline. The thought would be you would grow up additional like-for-like habitat before you do any activities that could possibly create a mitigation debt. And then the third one is a temporary elevated baseline as a means to prevent temporary mitigation debt to baseline. So perhaps there's some temporary loss of habitat function because you've improved habitat. The thought is as long as you're maintaining the same amount of of habitat across the landscape, we would be watching for that. And I should also say, grain of salt, in the sense of this is still, this entire program is still draft, and it's still something that we're negotiating with the Fish and Wildlife Service, but I think conceptually, we haven't run into any red flags so far. But the thought is, process-wise, we're working on a draft. We'll get the green light from Fish and Wildlife Service to start the NEPA public comment period. We'll do that, and then they'll determine at that point in time whether to issue a permit associated with this safe harbor agreement or not. And so, while I don't anticipate this to change tremendously, recognize that it's still squishy. So I
just
Okay, can I ask a question?
For everyone else.
I'm still in the window of asking dumb questions here, but normally when you talk about habitat for spotted owls, you're talking about, are you talking about habitat being the full range, nesting, roosting, foraging, dispersal, has to be all four, or are you talking about specific types of habitat as being part of the baseline?
So, correct me if I'm wrong, Paula, NERF habitat is kind of the minimum functionality that's incorporated into young forest marginal, submature, old growth. So, unlike other kind of programmatic agreements where we focus on functionality, we're just using the forest practices rules definitions of habitat, just because we've got GIS layers that we've been kind of tracking habitat on that so far. So the function is, this would all be at minimum here.
Gotcha. Thanks.
Good question, though. So, again, trying to show you instead of tell you, as best as Microsoft Paint can do, I put together some parcel definition or examples of these three elevated baseline bins. So the first one, which was the really main additional grown net conservation benefit habitat on the landscape, and you're calling it an elevated baseline because perhaps you've been given a conservation easement on the landscape. So the four is on the left, the blue would be if a landowner participating in this program had baseline habitat at the beginning of the allotment. And the kind of grayish pink is the net conservation benefit habitat. So habitat that was not there at the beginning of the agreement that you have grown into at minimum young forest marginal characteristics or higher. And what you would do then is you kind of determine what you want your elevated baseline to look like. So, at the end of the agreement, you're still eligible to remove the net conservation benefit, but that if you've agreed to an elevated baseline, that becomes your new kind of, you have to keep it on landscape. So, you know, as the slide says, a landowner may achieve a greater level of conservation value for the spotted owl by opting to leave an elevated baseline in the property as a proposed conservation measure, and we anticipate that this could pair pretty well with financial incentives.
Thank you.
So, are you going to talk more about where and how financial incentives might fit into this picture later, or is this the time to?
So I can just jump on that right now. Financial incentives certainly has been a conversation in the implementation team for many years now, but the focus has been, as of late, just getting this programmatic safe harbor agreement up and running. So I think that's kind of the how to finance something that the implementation team still needs to pick up and figure out. But you know, ROSP is one example, recognizing that there's much more out there.
So, just to be clear, so the green area, elevated baseline, that would be the area that you'd be looking at trying to marry up some financial incentive with?
Yeah, potentially. And it might just be that, you know, there's some landowners that may just do this regardless of whether there was a financial incentive or not. Perhaps there's some sort of conservation easement, or maybe they wanted to harvest the net conservation benefit faster. Maybe for hypothetically, instead of you know growing for 40 years through this program, they're able to shave it down to 30-year harvest sooner because they're maybe more on the landscape and providing a greater benefit sooner. So there's the thought is DNR would be communicating this with the landowner and trying to figure out what option works for the landowner and the bird. So the second image note, all of these images are not to scale, and also that these are all still conceptual. But an elevated baseline is a means to prevent mitigation debt. So an elevated baseline would involve the landowner identifying other current or future habitat by and adding those acres to the baseline as an upfront mitigation prior to any activity that would impact the original baseline. So maybe you're putting a road through or you're doing some sort of activity that could permanently impact the habitat. If for whatever reason it makes sense to kind of shift that regulatory polygon, so to speak, somewhere else adjacent to that activity. We're still working through the details and the sideboards on that. So the last one is a temporary elevated baseline for temporary impacts. We realized through our deliberations that there's, in likely rare circumstances, habitat that's currently on the landscape that is degrading and may not continue to function as habitat in the short term and requires some level of management or activity to improve that and put it on a trajectory to maintain and to grow and improve as habitat. So the thought is, because we're operating under a no mitigation debt process, agreeing to the permanent elevated baseline for temporary impacts would create a disincentive to do any of that beneficial work. So the thought is that the baseline habitat is improved, but maybe it's taken out of function for, 5 years or however much we have to figure out, that you would make sure before you do those activities that you have grown up additional like habitat to buffer in case something goes sideways. And also to, if the impacts are short term, then your regulatory burden on that would be short term.
Lauren?
Thank you. Just to maybe provide a more concrete example of when that would happen. So you have a stand that's got high tree stock density, and it's kind of at the edge of its habitat now, but you're worried about drought or insects taking it out of habitat by opening up like a bunch of trees behind and opening up, or just it reduces function. And a landowner is like, hey, if I go in and thin that, I could really prevent it from sliding out of habitat and increase its functionality over time. But if I might have to take enough trees out of it, canopy cover is 60% for 5 or 10 years instead of 70%. And then this would allow them protection, and since you can't incur mitigation debt under safe harbor policy, this would allow you to do that stuff in your baseline habitat, and then, but not temporary baseline idea is then to not have a permanently elevated baseline, so you're not actually saying, hey, I want to do an improvement, but in order to do that, I have to pay for that by an increased set aside. So that was the concept behind this.
Great. So with that, I'm happy to take more questions. Our thought is we're still working with the implementation team and the services to get a final draft together for review. Our thought would be between now and the May board meeting that board members will start to see some draft to review and that we have a more comprehensive update in May.
I'll add to that, the other thing that we've started doing this month is helping Lauren actually coupling up the great policy work she's been doing with the NSOIT and having our operations part of our group, coupling up with her so that we can see how actually once we get there, what kind of staff work is it going to take to actually implement? Do we need to do anything regarding rulemaking or not? I'm not saying we are, but we just need to get all the pieces in play and understand what it looks like. Any questions from the board members? Okay, thank you, Lauren. I'm going to suggest, because I've been seeing everybody twitch in the room, let's take a break until 3:15, please.